to go, because you're simply not going to be able to cram and do well on these tests. As I said before, since you have a syllabus, I expect to you should expect to be tested harder. I think some of you maybe didn't. I think some of you'll do better next time. You get the idea of what I want. Yeah. No, let's see, one. Well, it depends. See, no, we'll have four exams. Would be 25% probably. If we have we have four sections, it would be 25%. I've changed it since I put this out. I've changed my policy on that. Okay, next test may, we'll see. We're talking about the final repression of heathenism and heresy. We're seeing the church now, when it is sort of in the catbird seat. The church is in control. The emperor needs the church. The Roman society, Roman Empire, especially in the West, is disintegrating. And so the emperor needs the church, which is very strong organizationally. In 380, and I point out here on the bottom of page 71 of our syllabus, Theodosius, the emperor, made Christianity, as interpreted by the Bishop of Rome, the standard of Catholicity. All others are declared non-churches and therefore illegal. It was one step for the empire to make paganism illegal, but it was something else, another step, to make all non-Catholic churches. That is, and what was a Catholic church? What did they mean by Catholic? Well, the real church. And what is the real church? Well, here you see, it's a good test question, as interpreted by the Bishop of Rome. I keep saying this. The Roman Catholic Church teaches that there was only one church during this period, not a lot of denominations like we have now. That simply is false. We've already run into them, haven't we? The Donatists, the Novationists, the Marcionites, the Montanists, various monarchian groups, you know, little heretical groups here and there. And we don't know who else, for sure. No major groups. And so, in contrast to all these others, it is now that the state declares illegal, any church that is not Catholic, and Catholic is whatever the Bishop of Rome says is Catholic or true. Yes.
Was this the origin of what accounts the dogma that if you're now being Catholic, if you want any other church, you
would be... the church has always had that view. Yes. Which is logical.
Even though it's carried over to today, if I used to be Catholic, and although it weren't real strict about my family, you know, it was wrong for us, according to the Catholic Church, if we went to another church.
Yes. Yeah. It goes back into this period. You cannot have any, these are illegal. These are not real churches. Yes, those go back to this period. The idea of exclusivity has always been around, although not, the prohibition, but
your problem.
Under the code of Theodosius, I give you the citation here. He says, it is our desire that all the various nations which are subject to our clemency and moderation should continue in the profession of that religion which was delivered to the Romans by the divine apostle Peter. This idea is there by now, well established. As it hath been preserved by the Pontiff Damasius, and by Peter, Bishop of Alexandria, man of apostolic holiness, we authorize the followers of this law. See, one, as interpreted by the Bishop of Rome, to assume the title of Catholic Christians, but as for the others, since in our judgment they are foolish madmen, we decree that they shall be branded with the ignominious name of heretics, and shall not presume to give to their conventicles, the gatherings, you see, the name churches. You cannot call yourself a church. We see this in Episcopalianism later on. You get the chapel. The Methodists can only be chapels. Church of England is a church. See, it's the same idea way back here. They will suffer in the first place the chastisement of the divine condemnation. God will get them. And the second punishment, which our authority, in accordance with the will of heaven, shall decide to inflict. They go into two problems. Heaven will condemn you, but before heaven gets around to it, we'll take care of it, from our point of view. Ignominious means humiliation. Ignominious means... something as ignominious as stands in humiliation, shameful, embarrassing. When AD 385, six heretics were executed for heresy, the first death sentences. 385, the first, and boy, there's going to be a bunch of them later. The first of very, very, very many. For the first time, you have six people, six heretics, who are put to death for heresy. Very important thing. What was the attitude of the church fathers toward these actions? Well, I list them, I summarize. In the beginning, they approved the repression, but not the persecution and execution. That is, they sanctioned such actions as confiscating the church buildings, fines, disband them, you know, don't permit them to meet. But the church in the beginning did not sanction actual persecution and execution. Later on, the church came to sanction the violence against heretics. It was Augustine, who's the most influential of the Western Church Fathers, of course, who set the attitude. And he was writing concerning Donatism in North Africa. You recall that problem there? It's a Northern African heresy. He writes this: "For the Donatists met with the same fate as the accusers of the Holy Daniel. For as the Alliance were turned against them, so the laws by which they had proposed to crush an innocent victim were turned against the Donatists," which wasn't quite true. "Save that, by the mercy of Christ, the laws which seem to be opposed to them are in reality their truest friends." Now, this is what a persecutor always says: "I'm doing you a favor." Because whether it's a communist persecutor, or a Nazi, or a Catholic, or a Protestant later on. You got that? "I am doing it for your own good. The laws which outlawed heretics and called for their punishment, which seem to be opposed to them, are in reality their truest friends, for through their operation, many of them have been and are daily being reformed." That's a fundamental idea which undergirds, one of the fundamental ideas which undergirds persecution. That is, that the threat of pain or death can produce reform. Now, you'd think the church would have learned that that's not true through its many centuries of, three centuries or 2.5 centuries of persecution by the Roman state. You think by 323 the church would have known better. Isn't this blindness? When the church was being persecuted, they would deny, of course, that you can bring about true repentance and reform by threatening death. Wasn't the church fighting over this? When these Christians gave in and later wanted to repent, you see? Well, it's the same kind of issue. But now that the church is on the other side, Augustine says, Augustine became the authority for the persecution for hundreds of years. You go into the Middle Ages, into the 16th century, when Protestants are persecuted, and when Catholics are persecuted by Protestants, they go back to Augustine. Did you see that? The idea that threat of punishment or death can truly reform and return God thanks that they are reformed and delivered from their ruinous madness. He continues, and another part of this discussion, "As then the apostle says, as we have therefore opportunity, let us do good to all men." Must not think of persecutors as being cruel, inhuman people. They aren't. Don't mean to be anyway. But we're doing good to all men, not being weary in well-doing. So let all be called to salvation. Let all be called from the path of destruction. I underline the word all. Those who may be by the sermons of the Catholic preachers, that is the true preachers, those who may be by the edicts of the Catholic princes, that is the king, the governor. Some through those who obey the warnings of God, some through those who obey the emperor's command. You see, we're just doing what God says. We're going to win everybody. And those who will win by preaching, we'll win those. But if we can't win them by preaching, then we'll win them by the law. We'll make it illegal. Now, it seems very far from the way we think, doesn't it? But I'm spending time on this because I want you to see it, that once this standard is set, this is followed by the church for centuries. And by the way, still it's the official position of the Roman Catholic Church. They can't carry it out now, but they do, except informally. By the way, Mexico, for instance, the Protestants are persecuted as much as the local, as the authorities will let the local church get away with it. I have acquaintances who have been genuinely persecuted in Mexico, for instance, in those countries, mainly Mexico. But back in the hills, you see, away from the law, or where the law turns its back. So the Roman Catholic Church follows this policy, has followed it, and would follow it today if they could get away with it, in my opinion. The assumptions underlying the justification of persecution are these. Number one, all who are not baptized into the Catholic or state church shall be tormented in hell for eternity. Therefore, repression, threats, and punishments bring about many true conversions and prevent the spread of damnable heresies to other people. Persecution, therefore, is an act of love toward heretics and an act of wisdom on behalf of the state. It preserves the social order. Why do you persecute them? Because you love them. You say, you do it for the good, and it's for the greater good. Persecution is always for the greater good. And by the way, if you follow that logic, it makes sense. We get all high and mighty about it. But if you believe that these teachings automatically, if when accepted by other people, sent people to hell for eternity, is it not better that one should die than the whole nation die? That's the argument that was given when Jesus was crucified, and by it, there's a certain logic to it, isn't it? I'm not justifying it. I'm not advocating. I'm simply saying we need to look at it from their point of view. And this was, keep in mind, this was a cruel age, and it was assumed that persecution could bring about change. This was the old trial by pain or trial by fire days. People thought this way, and coming from their point of view, there was a logic supporting it. They were not just cruel, inhuman beasts. You see that? These were godly men. But we must, if we're going to be fair, not to justify or vindicate, but if we're going to be fair, we're going to have to see them in terms of their own age, not our age. And in terms of their age, their decisions, while not acceptable to us, they are certainly, we can understand a little bit why they would do it. See, so here you got a man who's teaching a false doctrine. Well, look, if he persuades 10 men, that means 10 are going to go to hell for eternity. Isn't it better that he dies now and send him off into hell early than to take 10 with him? Right? See, there's kind of a twisted logic about that, isn't there? Because we would not accept that, but they did. And keep in mind that in that age it was accepted. That kind of thing was accepted. Well, you can see that, can't you? I mean, it's very bad history to judge people in terms of our civilization, our culture. We're going to run to that time and time again. Well, let's move on quickly now. Look at the organization of the church in the 4th century, up into the period of the, remember the Imperial State Church? You recall what we're calling this? The Ancient Catholic Church up to 323, the Imperial State Church following that. Very quickly, in the West, the emperor found that he assumed more and more control over the church. You got the word state in your syllabus. It's a misprint. Mistake. He did not claim absolute control over the church. However, in the East, the seat of rule of the emperor came to be the absolute rule of the church in this period. Remember that Constantine moved his capital to Byzantium. The Roman Empire is now the Byzantine Empire. And what did he? And he changed the name to Constantinople. But you see, we're going to see that in the East you have Caesaropapism, and Laterette discusses this. But so you had more absolute control in the East than you did in the West by the emperor. I think the basic reason is, why did the emperor come to control the church more directly, where you had where you had the office of Caesar and the office of Pope in the same man, whereas in the West you always had the king and the Pope, and always fighting each other, who's number one. We're going to see that time and time again. Well, one of the basic reasons is that the emperor was in the East and he wasn't in the West. He was there to press his claim. There are many other reasons, but that's one of the basic reasons. You see that? So while in the East you have Caesaropapism, eventually, at least it leads into it during this period, in the West you always have this dichotomy of king versus Pope. And we're going to meet that problem again. Are you with me? Okay. What was the position of the bishops? The church is now episcopal, and I referred to that parenthetical summary of the different kinds of church governments. You can look back at that, yes. Well, whoever it is during this period, any number of them, yes. In the 4th century, in addition, and I put this in, I'm going to go over this with you, and I'm not going to really call you too much to account on this, except you ought to recognize the terms. be able to recognize these and define them. But it's rather complicated. In the fourth century, in addition to diocesan bishops, that's a bishop over an area, a whole number of cities, there appeared metropolitan bishops and patriarchs, that is, bishops over other bishops, but in a particular arrangement. Metropolitan bishops, later they were called archbishops in Europe, still are. You ever heard of the Archbishop of Canterbury? The metropolitan bishops were bishops over capital cities, what the name metro means, capital cities of the various provinces who were over other bishops in that province. This was patterned after the organization of the government. The Bishop of Rome, for example, was the metropolitan bishop of southern Italy. So he would be Bishop of Rome, but finally, the Bishop of Rome came to be the metropolitan over all of southern Italy, so that he was not only over the church at Rome, but he was over the other bishops in that area. We've already talked about this evolution. Patriarchs were outstanding metropolitan bishops. They became bishops over the most important cities: Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem for old times, like I put that in. Jerusalem was important because of its sentimental importance. It was not important for any other reason during this period. It was a real backwater, you know, in and of itself, but because the church began there. So that, and they exercised authority over areas of the empire, that is, over other metropolitan bishops. You see the hierarchy? You would have local bishops over cities, but then you have a metropolitan bishop who would be over the lesser towns in his community, and then over the real really important towns, you would have patriarchs. You still have this title in the Eastern Church, Eastern Orthodox Church, and they are the more important metropolitan bishops, that is, the metropolitan bishops in the more important cities, and they had authority over other metropolitan bishops. And eventually, this gets up to one bishop over the whole church, of course, is the Pope, as this evolved. You see that? Yes. Yes. The ancients thought in terms of cities, not of nations. You don't have people thinking in terms of nations until the Renaissance. Well, you had the rise of nations contributed to the Renaissance. People thought in terms of cities. Remember Paul did, I'm a citizen of no mean city, and I've already talked about this a little bit. But to help you understand, and really all this reflect, this was the way the Roman government was set up. The Roman Empire was, the government of the Roman Empire was set up, and it just corresponded to it. Then we come to the councils. That's a very interesting subject here, but I want you to see how this developed, it's evolved. It's still around today. You still see leftovers. You still see, by the way, in the East, old Caesaropapism, vestiges of it. For instance, the power of the Orthodox Church in Russia until at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. You still see it on Cyprus. Who's the governor of Cyprus? The bishop, the patriarch, is the governor of Cyprus. Was, you know, in the East. Now, you found it seems very strange to us to see a prelate, a churchman, who is the governor, in fact, or like a king. But in the East, it was very common for a long period of time. It's disintegrating now, of course, about gone. The councils. It is through the councils that the bishop exercised their control, I point out. They legislated through councils. The first council on record was in 160, called to deal with the Montanists, you recall, the first charismatic movement. By the 4th century, councils were established as part of the machinery of the church. They go back to the Great Jerusalem Conference, Acts chapter 15, as their precedent. So now you have this hierarchy of bishops, and you have the councils that meet regularly, part of the machinery, twice every year in the provinces. And the metropolitan was the permanent moderator. As needs, so you have local councils over different metropolitan areas. You'll see that like Rome, Constantinople, Antioch, Alexandria. When real bad problems came along, you would have what were called ecumenical councils. By ecumenical, it meant takes in the whole church. These represented the whole church. Sometimes they were called by the emperor if he thought the problem was bad enough. And many were called, but the Roman Catholic Church recognized only 7 as being valid councils. The reason is, we're going to see this later, come back to this, but the reason is that, of course, the idea came along later that the God spoke through these councils. The decision of the councils constitute divine revelation, and therefore, if you have God speaking through these councils, you can only accept those counsels where God said what you agree with. If some of the councils decide something you can't accept, then you just say what the Roman Catholic Church does. Basically is, you'll see that if the council decides something they didn't like, an ecumenical council, they simply say, well, it wasn't a council. It was a maverick council. It was illegal, unofficial. And they only accept seven. Now these are in the these are back here, by the way, in your syllabus. I've included this information for you, but you'll come to it later. Okay? Yes.
That last sentence you got there,
would
that mean is your definition of
them being altered? Yes. It's true. We come to the lesser clergy. The presbyters have become priests. We've already introduced to this in the earlier period. They're now full-fledged priests, functioning as in a sacerdotal way. You know what that word means now. They were in charge of a single church under the authority of the bishop, much like the Roman Catholic and Episcopal system is now. The deacons have declined in importance. The deacons were simply stepping stones to the priesthood. By the way, you see something analogous in this. I think it's very unfortunate that most of our churches, and many of our churches, and perhaps not most, being a deacon is sort of is really not a functioning office. It's just sort of a preliminary step to the eldership. That's very unfortunate. The deacons had a very important part of the early church, but they just sort of they became very much less important than they always have been since. We never have restored that, by the way. Some churches have. You see, for instance, I like to see a church set up so that your major leaders, like your Bible school superintendents and your those who are head over the major areas of the church, are at least deacons. See, good job. But anyway, let's look at clerical legislation. We've already been introduced to this. We'll move very quickly through this. First of all, we looked at the clerical exemptions. Well, later, secular occupations were forbidden. That if you were a clergyman, you could not hold a secular job. And the Roman Catholic Church still preserves that, of course. Well, except unless it's teaching, like in a, they can teach and do, they can hold certain jobs. Exceptions are made, but you couldn't be a farmer, see, if you were a priest. Next, I trace for you the idea of clerical celibacy. What is celibacy? No marriage, no sex. In 8325, the Council of Nicaea refused to legislate celibacy. We talked about the growing tendency toward the Hellenistic mindset, toward Greek dualism, toward asceticism. And so there's pressure coming from all sides. Yet, it was an issue at Nicaea, 325. We're going to talk about the Council of Nicaea again later as well. But Council refused to legislate it. They said, in effect, if you want to practice celibacy, it's okay, but it's not a law. In 8390, Bishop Siricus issued a decretal, it should be one E in decretal, by the way, that the clergy should remain unmarried. He was the Patriarch of the West. Leo the Great, sometimes called the first pope, because the church had evolved pretty much by this time, into what came to be the Roman Catholic system. He issued the decree in the form which it finally became accepted in the West. However, note the great time span, it did not become universally practiced, even in theory, until after the year 1000. It's a pretty hard thing to legislate. So it came on the scene, but it was resisted for a long time. It was not a universally accepted practice. And by the way, it never has been practiced, actually. It's not widespread. But it was the majority, I think it's generally admitted by everybody, it's the majority of those who take the vow of celibacy do not keep it. Worldwide, I mean, you may have the majority in a particular country. You might have a majority of American Catholic priests who would keep their vow. But, friends, we're going to see in the Dark Age, in the High Middle Ages, they didn't and nobody expected them to. Not really, you see. But it did not, you follow me? It did not become universally accepted even in theory. As the idea, it wasn't just sort of generally accepted until after the year 1000. In the Eastern Church, only bishops came to be celibate. Priests could marry. However, if you married, you could not become a bishop. And by the way, that is still the law in the Orthodox Church, and it's also the law, we're going to see later, in the Episcopalian Church, the Anglican Church, Church of England. That is, the Church of England, a bishop has to have a celibate life. The local Anglican priest can marry. It's up to them. But if you marry, then you just give up on the idea of becoming a bishop.
What about if they were a bishop first?
And then you can't get married.
Was it lifelong?
Pretty much, unless it's pretty much lifelong, unless they did something real bad to heaven. Archbishop, a ruling bishop, or archbishop would move, remove them from office. All some did, but see, but he got married, he was out. Y'all see that? So it was limited celibacy. Clerical garb, by the way, and this last point is very important. In this period, it was viewed as the law of the church, not the law of God. And by the way, the Roman Catholic Church still takes that position, technically. But this is a law of the church, not a law of God. And they would pretty much say this, that you decide to serve the church in this way, then you make this decision. Big, a lot of pressure on now for priests to marry. Many priests are going ahead and marrying and defying the church, but not the Orthodox ones, not the conservatives. Well, so much for one more point. Clerical garb. When did you begin to have this thing of costumes? And I've already mentioned this a little bit when I talk about the symbols of the church. Clerical garb began to be the custom. It grew out of the dress, as I point out, of Roman gentlemen to stand in contrast to the barbarians. When Western culture became primarily barbaric, you had two classes of people, or more than that, but two basic classes. You had the old aristocracy, the old civilized people, the gentlemen, and you had these new barbarians. And as the barbarians became gentlemen, you had the peasant dress, you know, the common, and so it was felt to be necessary. The Romans had a custom of this, of particular clothes distinguish your economic class. And by the way, many societies have that. Such as European societies, peasant garb, there was a style of dressing which is recognized as peasant and as opposed to the gentlemanly dress. By the way, you see this preserved in the tuxedo. The tuxedo is a vestige of the idea that of a dress that only gentlemen wear. And so Europe has a long tradition of this. America has, we have an informal tradition. We have the business suit as opposed to the coverall. Usually it's utilitarian. But the priests were, the clergy was supposed to be gentlemen, not of the lower barbaric classes. Originally it grew from the simple desire for a dignity in dress. Later it came to be a uniform. Priestly uniform, and with this tradition went on for a long time, still around very much. In some groups, you see, you know, the priestly uniform, the nuns, and of course, that goes along with the clergy system. They have a special class, and they wear a special dress. Now, of course, there are modifications of today. Some groups, you know, wear a business suit. Some Anglican groups, low Anglican groups, some are high Methodist groups, or some others. Some Lutheran groups will have their preachers wear a business suit but with a clerical collar. You've seen that, you know, ordinary business suit, but the collar is clerical, as opposed to the whole outfit. And then they don't have to wear them at all times. So that, those are degrees of that. Well, we come now to the German invasions, and I want to finish this today, if we can, and I'm not going to say too much about this. I put this, a copy of this, in your syllabus, so you don't, and this is not really complete, but it gives us some idea that the land areas are light. First of all, let's talk about the German tribes before the Great Invasion. And you understand these invasions took place over many, many, many years, many phases, very complicated. And I'm not going to expect you to know, you know, every detail invasion and all that. But first of all, before they came south, many of the Germanic tribes, you understand what we mean by Germanic tribes? Basically, we mean the northern tribes, called Germanic, Teutonic, Anglo-Saxon, others, the ancestors of most of us, I'm sure. Before they came south, many tribes, individual tribes, were already converted to Christianity. Now we're going to. It was Arian Christianity, and we haven't got to the Arian controversy because we're dealing with these. What I'm doing, of course, is taking these sections of time, dealing with them topically. So we haven't come to the topic of Arianism in this section yet, but so you'll know what I mean as we go along. But many of them were converted to Arian Christianity. A Goth, little Phias, was captured. He was converted and released to go back to his people. He did, began to convert his people. He translated the Bible into the language of his people. Very fine man, except for Samuel and Kings. As I put in the syllabus, he decided not to translate Samuel and Kings because there was too much fighting in those books. His people already were doing too much of that anyway. These were very warlike people, by the way, always have been. Still are. From the Goths, other tribes learned Christianity. These tribes did not include the Franks and the Anglo-Saxons. By the way, the Anglo-Saxons were some of the later ones to come into the picture as far as Christianity is concerned. But keep in mind, it was Arian Christianity that denied the deity of Jesus, did not make Jesus a created being. So when they came down, they already had a respect for Christianity. They were, and that's a good way to put it, they were not Orthodox. We would not accept them as Christians necessarily. They were not Orthodox Christians as defined by the Bishop of Rome, because he defined orthodoxy, but at least we're on safe grounds of saying that they had a respect for Christianity. You often see in movies and get the impression that these were just absolutely wild horsemen, wild tribesmen who would just raid, loot, rape, and all that. That really is not a true picture. They were barbaric, and it's illiterate, fundamentally uncivilized, not completely illiterate, but break down the great invasions. The Visigoths, which means Western Goth, broke into the Balkans in 376 and came down to Italy. See them here? This is the line we're following here now, okay?
You've got this on your syllabus.
I'll move over here because I'm taping this. But Visigoths broke into the Balkans in 376, into Italy. They moved slowly for many years, but keep in mind, they were not simply, they were not a war party. They brought their families with them, animals. They came to stay. The southern climate, there was money, there was civilization, there was wealth, which is the same as money. They were migrating. They were not raiding. They were migrating. See the difference? The Vandals moved through Spain. You see the Vandals up there on the overhead? You can pick it on your map. The Vandals moved through Spain, crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, and conquered sections of northern Africa. They were exceedingly destructive, and northern Africa was very wealthy. The Christian forces were divided between the Donatists and the Catholic, or the Orthodox, who we call the Donatist faction. And so the Christian forces were divided. They did not present a united front. But note the comment I make here. The Vandals did not mean to destroy civilization. They respected it. But they were barbarians. That's very important to see. They lacked what they saw in the city. The idea of the noble savage, you know, in the wilderness, who's just perfectly happy to live off the land is a lot of foolishness. It always has been foolishness. It was foolishness with the American Indian, by the way, for the most part. The idea of the happy savage, this came from this is James Fenimore Cooper, but it's not history. These cities, the wealth, they saw the culture, they wanted it. But they didn't know how to do it. They ended up destroying, and of course, much of the destruction came as a result of the fighting. They had to. We saw much of this in the Second World War, where the Allies were forced to reduce much of Germany to rubble, not because they wanted to, but because it was forced upon them because the Germans would not surrender, and they were simply defending these cities. They would hide out in these cities, and they would have to bomb them. Do that or just, you know, walk away from it. And think what it would be like today. Suppose you had a group of people came into Orlando, raided us out of the hill somewhere, who were basically uncivilized. What would happen? They like you know, the flush toilet and running water. See, they like school systems. They like buses, but, you know, public transportation. The telephone system is great. And TV, you see. But suppose they just came in and everybody else pulled out. What would happen to all these facilities? It's one thing to like a public water system, something else to know how to make it run. Something to like telephones that How do you make them run? And by the way, during the Second World War, of course, you see analogies of this, that the army, when they went into these cities, the military forces, they had whole corps of men prepared to administer these cities. They would just take in experts on the communications, experts on water systems, a city manager, as it were, put them under martial law. The first thing they have to do is get everything working again. See? Like get the electricity turned on, get the phones hooked up, get the modern society. And of course, a very technical, how about a banking system? See? What would happen if you had barbarians and all the bankers pulled out? What would your money be worth? You see? Who would run the computers? You see the analogy there? So do not picture these people as being 100% cruel, who just went in and burned and stood by and cackled as the city went up in smoke. There was cruelty, there was rape, there was pillage. But it is not true that they came in with that idea exclusively. Tell me? They liked what they saw. They wanted to move in. By the way, but they just didn't understand how a high civilization worked. They liked the school system, the education, the great schools, didn't they? Well, anyway, the Burgundians, Burgundy wine is named for these people, moved into the southern part of France, which is now still called Burgundy, and that's on our transparency. The Franks, the strongest of the German people, the word France comes from these ancient Franks, the strongest of the Germanic nations, moved into southern France. Remember, they were not converted. They were not to any form of Christianity, the Franks or the Anglo-Saxons. The Anglo-Saxons invaded England, driving out the Celtic peoples, and they did not enter England as Christians. Very important to know that later on. You got that? So you have two major countries. This is going to be important to understand the history that developed. The Franks came into France as pure barbarians. No concept of Christianity at all. The Anglo-Saxons moved in around the Celt, the original population of England out, well, suppressed them. And that's why, for instance, you find in Wales, ancient Celtic spoke, which is a vestige of the original language of those people. It's like the American Indian, almost. Well, it is like the American Indian. We're going to see that France and England were two of the most uncivilized countries for a long time. Italy suffered the most because of its wealth. In 410, the Visigoths captured Rome, or the Vandals invaded and sacked Rome from the south. The Huns came and the city was saved by Leo, but we're going to meet him later. Various Germanic kingdoms were set up, but none lasted very long. They couldn't make it work. You see that? They couldn't make the high civilization work, and the Roman forces would drive them back out. After Justinian, the Lombards, who were very tall, blonde people, came down to northern Italy. And by the way, if you go to northern Italy today, you often think of the Italians as being rather short and dark. If you go into northern Italy today, you will see a lot of people are tall and blonde. And you can still see very clearly the descendants of the ancient Lombards, where people came into northern Italy. Well, that's a very brief look at this. Civilization was progressively destroyed. Only the church survived. As one historian said, the barbarians came in, even though they didn't really mean to. They reduced Western civilization, Carthage, Rome, now Spain, to ashes, and the church arose from the ashes and converted the conquerors. The church was waiting for them. We're going to see this, that the next generation of leaders in the church are these converted barbarians, at least fairly converted. And just looking ahead, taking the big picture, remember this when you find it difficult to understand how you can have such things as the Crusades, as the Knights, Christian warriors. You find people who, in the name of Christ, in the feudalistic society, which is a very harsh, we would say, barbarian society. But you understand that these people were barbarians, and the form of Christianity they met was very diluted. What was the relation of the church to these German tribes? We'll finish this, and we'll finish for the day. What was the relation of the church to these Germanic tribes? First of all, the conversion of the Franks to Catholic Christianity took place, and this was very important. You got that? To official Christianity, as opposed to Arian Christianity. Keep in mind, the Franks into what is now France and southern France. In 496, Clovis, the king of the Franks, was converted. He thought Christianity was a great idea. Now, keep in mind, was this a genuine conversion? I don't know. Yes and no. One of the many reasons I'm sure that he converted was that he saw that Christianity was the path to culture, and they wanted a higher culture. And so he won a battle by he was stuck. I won't go into the details. He was losing a battle, or he thought he was, and he called on Christ. You know, no sense trying. I mean, no harm in trying. He called upon the Christian's God, Christ, to help him. He called all the rest of his gods, and everybody could think of, and they weren't helping much. And for some reason, he won the battle. So he thought this was a sign from heaven. He was converted. And he decided he would fight for the Christian's God. We would not accept this as a... In other words, we say, was he converted to real Christianity? You know anything about biblical Christianity? What he meant was not biblical Christianity. It was a state religion, very diluted. You understand that? He was converted to what he understood Christianity to be. So he commanded his people to be converted. Why not? And from here, of course, is the legend that his soldiers were baptized with their sword arms held out of the water. This legend, and this is also an illustration. You know, some people are baptized with their billfold out. The idea was that, of course, that Christianity taught love and peace, but in the world in which he lived, listen to me, and again, judge him in terms of his own age, not accept or condone, just see him in terms of his own age. He lived in a world where the very idea that anybody could exist without fighting was just simply unthinkable, and he was probably right. And so he did not want to hinder the fighting spirit of his men. So he had them hold their sword. At least the story is told. We don't know if it's true. It's a legend. It may or may not be true. But it represents the thinking of the age, even if it's not true. Keep the sword arm out so that if you've got any fighting to do, or just sort of symbolic that. We're Christians now. We're Christians. We accept Jesus of Nazareth. But, brother, that doesn't mean that you're free to walk all over us. See, because they were fighting for their survival at a very warlike age, and he had plans. As one historian said, Clovis, quote, I think this is beautiful, gave up not a single pagan vice and adopted not a single Christian virtue. And a very important alliance was forged between the leaders of the Franks and the Catholic Church. Keep in mind, Western Roman civilization was disintegrating. The church was fighting for its life. Here was the most powerful tribe of all, the Franks. Clovis, the king of the France, king of the Franks. And so they said, in effect, look, we need each other. Let's go in together. And a close alliance was formed. You protect me, we'll protect you. You sanction what I do, we'll protect you from the other Germanic tribes. The Franks are better than the Vandals, better than some others. You see that? So it's mutual protection. Last of all, later, the Franks defeated the Goths. You see, remember I said Clovis had fighting to do, and he knew he did? They defeated the Goths and caused them to see the light. That is, they converted them to official Christianity. Remember, they made an alliance with the Bishop of Rome. They made an alliance with the true church, the official church. And so, in northern Italy and that part of Europe, when they defeated the Goths on behalf, Clovis and the Franks, they kept their part of the bargain. He commanded all the Arian Christians to convert to official Christianity, and of course you know how he did it. They defeated him in battle. It's either this or death, and they said, well, nobody ever explained to me that way before. This problem of how Jesus can be God is Arian Christianity. We're going to see later, like the Jehovah's Witness. Jesus is a created being, and Jesus cannot be God if God is one. At the end, of course, when you face death or conversion, you say, well, you know, sword under your throat says, you feel the prick of the sword in your throat, and you say, you know, I can begin to see how Jesus could be God, and yet God be one. You know, it began to come through to me. I can really see this now. And so it came through to them. But keep in mind, their original conversion was very superficial. They didn't have a whole lot to be converted to. And so this is why, by the way, throughout Europe, Arian Christianity survived only in the East. Still does survive, by the way. Arian Christianity, just looking ahead, survived only in the East. The reason it didn't survive in the West was, well, one of the reasons was, that the Franks won. The Goths were their concept of Christianity, to the extent that they had a concept of Christianity, was Arian, the Franks won, and it converted them. So the gospel, what was left of them, became official Christians. Does that make sense to you? Very hard for us. Let me say one more word, then we'll quit. It's very hard for us to visualize what's going on. Isn't it? It is for me. What did society look like? It was very informal, very unstable. You did not have nations. You had towns that were often, they sort of existed in and for themselves. Alliances had to be made. Everything was in disruption. Everything was in flux. You had the old, the new. It's so far removed from our world that I want you to know I appreciate the difficulty you have in visualizing, you know, what's really going on. You can see the facts, you see the evidence, you see the charts and the maps, but that really doesn't create a very clear picture. Well, things are pretty much of a mess. The church is not, the Western world is on its way into a dark age, and it was a mess for a long time.